Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show, the show dedicated to discovering the jewels of wisdom used for increasing ROI for REIs. That is, return on investment for real estate investors. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 105 with Chris Prefontaine on $75,000 average profit per deal. When I booked Chris, I was thinking exactly what you are right now. $75,000 average profit per deal? No way. I'm lucky to do that once or twice per year, and I'm closing hundreds of deals. You can bet that Chris and I dig deep into the details of exactly how to assemble these $75,000 deals. But before we get started, you should know that Chris is the founder of Smart Real Estate Coach and host of the Smart Real Estate Coach podcast. I can assure you that this will not be a pitch fest. When I booked Chris, knowing he was a coach, I first checked into him and made sure he's actually doing deals. He's doing deals today, and he's been doing a large volume of deals ever since first getting into the real estate business more than 26 years ago. Word of warning, if you are taking notes on this one, you'll have to be quick. The speed of this episode was unusually fast, even for me. A lot of content and a lot of details in a very short period of time. Now that you've been warned, let's get to it. Welcome to the show, Mr. Chris Prefontaine.
Well, thanks for having me.
To give listeners a touch of background, tell us what market you are either located and or investing in right now, and then where you're recording from.
Sure. We are, Dan, in Newport, Rhode Island, in New England. Newport is actually a part of a three-town island in Rhode Island, so it's a tiny area. We, as a family team, it's myself and my wife, and we've got a great support team, primarily family, son-in-law and daughter. And so we're buying and selling all the time, mostly in Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and in Connecticut. And then we help students, we call them associates, all around the country in different markets. So we're hitting probably 25 or 26 different states.
Do you want to give listeners an idea how you got started in real estate? Maybe a quick progression, because I know you've been at the business a while, but a quick progression of how you came through and then got to what your business looks like today. Maybe paint a little picture of that as well.
Yeah, I'll give you a 10,000-foot view, and you can go back to any piece of it. Starting in back in 91, I'm dating myself, but I'll fast-forward you through. We were doing what I call spot building. We were locating single lots in existing subdivisions and putting up a home. We never had to come out of pocket, and we never did financing. We would build on the person's lot. We would pre-sell the home, build on the lot, and then the buyer would get financing. We did that until about 95. In 95, I bought a realty executive's franchise. I was a broker owner for a while with one intent: build it, get it profitable, and sell it. I did that in 2000, took over a banker. 2000 through about 2003 or so, I was coaching people throughout U.S. and Canada. So stayed in coaching pretty much since 2000. 2004, 5, 6, running up to the great debacle we had in 08, which I talk about in my book, because I'm an open, kind of blunt communicator. I let everybody know what the good and the bad is. So prior to that, we were doing a lot of condo conversions, you know, buying multi-units, converting them to condos and reselling them faster than we could do them then. And then in 08, the debacle kind of slapped us around a little bit. And then it forced us, after painfully going through about 3 or 4 years of workouts and short sales and all kinds of garbage, in the end of 12, beginning of 13, we totally re-engineered the business to what it is today. And that is, we do not use our own cash anymore. We do not sign on bank loans or pledge our credit or pledge anything. And so we're not risking anything personally and potentially messing that up like after 08. And we buy everything on terms. So we buy three ways. We buy owner financing to us, because you can do that a lot of different ways, as your listeners know. To us, that means the home's debt-free, and we're buying it by some kind of 4, 5, 6 year term, sometimes longer. And we're buying that with no interest. We're making monthly principal payments. So when I say owner financing, that's what I mean by owner financing. We also buy lease purchase and subject to the existing financing. Those are the three primary ways we buy, and we exit almost every single deal with rent-to-own buyers.
All right. I am writing as fast as I possibly can. I apologize, but I need to repeat the third one. It was lease purchase, owner finance, and what was the third?
Subject to existing financing. So you're a seller. You've got a loan on there that you need perhaps immediate debt relief, or you're leaving the state or something's there, there's urgency. So we'll buy the home. Loan stays in the seller's name, though.
Gotcha. Yeah, we've done a couple of those. I know a lot of people are excited by the prospect of those. The question burning on my mind, as you mentioned these couple, this is really cool, by the way, too. I don't mean to, you know, cut the rest of the story short. That progression and being able to spot the opportunities and then have to move. There's a book called Move the Cheese I remember reading in 2009 or 10 when I was broke. And if anyone hasn't read that, check it out, because the cheese will likely move in the next 3 or 4 years here in the real estate business at some point. But it's really cool to see how you had it go from one thing to the next to the next. And you were successful along the way at each of these points. Am I correct in that assumption?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in 08, we got slammed, right? So that was the only caveat, but you're exactly right. And so when we work with our associates, even Dan, around the country, that's kind of the deal. We don't just talk about real estate. One of our purpose statement as part of our value and purpose statement is to empower families and individuals. So yeah, it happens to be through real estate, but if the real estate market bops and weaves, we do that with it and we teach it.
Got it. So that's the real lesson. I know that it's obvious, and you know it's obvious, and a lot of listeners know it's obvious, that the 2008, 9, 10 experience, the workouts, the short sales, the bank loans you obviously had signed for during that period, it had changed your investing principle to today. Would you just kind of like dive into a little bit of detail for anybody that might not have made that connection, Chris?
Yeah, so you mean from 08 to the change, right?
Yeah, I mean, you're having to do all those things, and then your business model now is a reflection of lessons learned in that. I know that, but I'm assuming that maybe a few of the listeners, I know I want a little more detail as well.
Yeah, well, look, in 08, I like a lot of people said, not 08, but running up to 08, I like a lot of people said, hey, I got great credit, so I'm going to utilize it. I thought that was the right thing to do. And so I was on every commercial property, had every residential property, every condominium conversion property. And so when the market, I'll give you an example, when the market dropped in Providence, Rhode Island, on a building we were selling 6 units in for $172,000, we sold the first three, $172,000, almost overnight, within very short time, we could not get $50,000 to save our life. And so that building is in, so that's underwater, and now the banks are looking at who? Me. And so when you multiply that times 22 or 23 projects, that can get ugly. And so we just vowed never to go back there. And so now when we buy, even if it's owner financing, we never sign personally to date, have not. We carry 50 or 60 properties at any one time that haven't been cashed out yet, and none of them are we signing on, and will we ever. And we don't use our own cash. Now that we've built up the cash flow and the cash with our three different payday strategy, yes, we could by choice, and when we have killer deals, we might, but we did not do that for 4 years straight. So if people don't have money to invest, it's not a challenge.
Yeah, and I really love the detail, Chris, too. I don't typically have a lot of real estate coaches, mentors, and things of that nature on our show. And the ones I do have, I vet heavily the background and make sure, hey, did you actually do these things? Have you done some deals?
Exactly.
And, I'm really glad that you're diving into some of those details and deals, because that's how you know that you're dealing with the right person. I have a question about these type of deals. What is the marketing for the lead source? How do you go about finding any one of these deals if they're the same place, or do you have like three different type of marketing strategies for these? I mean, where are these deals, and how would you recognize them if one came across your desk?
Yeah, no, it's great you asked it first, Dan, because without it, there is no biz, right?
True enough.
You're not generating leads. There's nothing. So there's a number of different answers, but let me tell you the main ways we pull in the leads. And to answer the second piece first, these ways I'm going to tell you are for all three. So they're going to come across your desk, and then you're going to pivot and go to one of those three methods depending on the type of deal. And some deals can start off one way, i.e. lease purchase, and then a year or more down the road, and it's one of my favorite strategies, convert that to subject to, because they now trust you, like you have credibility, you've paid their mortgage for so long. So our two main ways are for sale by owners and expired listings. Market's screaming hot in a lot of areas right now. So us, as well as our students, will lean towards the expired listings because FSBOs are selling quickly on their own. Not all markets, but many right now, as you know. So those are the two main ways we generate leads.
That's interesting. So are we cold calling these, mailing them letters? Are we networking with agents until our feet wear through our shoes? How's it work?
Okay, so what we do, and again, most of our students, because I only, to your point about being in the trenches, we only teach them what we do. So the VA, virtual assistant, will call on for sale by owners. So we're only getting property information sheets. We call them lead sheets from him that are people that want to talk to us, right? He's kind of pre-vetted them. Those come in every single week to the tune of 18 or 20 for us. And then we have the expireds are being some dialed by a VA and some dialed in-house here by my son-in-law, who has designed a pretty cool system called expired dialing process that automates a lot of this. So you're hitting by automatic dial around 400 or 500 at a time, and then the serious ones call you back. So again, you're not insuring yourself to always talk to motivated people, but you are whittling down so that you're talking to more motivated people, more people that do want to talk to you. So no, you're not cold calling ever.
That's interesting. Do you guys have a pre-recorded message? Is there a tool that you could share that people could use online for doing those 400 batch calls? It's like a slide broadcast thing. How's it work?
Yeah, you said it at the end. Slide broadcast is a piece of the tools. We get all our leads from my plus on my resource section. Anyone can go use them. You can get expires in FSBOs now. And we do still, Dan, on occasion, dial, you know, old-fashioned dial, but they do use a power dialer, and they do use slide broadcast.
Yeah, we recently started using, you know, the calls out. We personally haven't had a ton of success, but I'm committed, just like I was committed years ago when my direct mail campaigns never developed any of the results, and I was pretty much barely breaking even. I'm committed to stay the course until I get it done. Chris, what if you have a seller that just wants the cash now? Are you guys going to wholesale that deal out to someone else? Are you funded enough that you're going to close on that today? I mean, from your own business, not necessarily the people who you coach and mentor, but some people, let's face it, they just want the cash. They don't care that it's going to be a lower price maybe than the lease option. So what would you do with that type of seller if they came across your desk, or do you not because of your lead source?
Yeah, so the short answer is we'll tell them if you're looking for top price in retail, we're not your buyer because we're not set up, we do them on occasion by accident, but we're not set up to scale wholesaling. So I have no desire if I can't scale it and I can't get big checks. The other piece of that, though, to your original question is think about it. Some of these sellers, there's not one FSBO that you would call that wouldn't say, I'm going to sell my own. Well, no kidding. That's why they're a FSBO. They think they're going to sell on their own. They think they're going to get full price. So we tell them, great, if anything changes or you don't get full price in the time you want, we're a great backup option. So a lot of those will just be a matter of follow-up. So we don't try to grab that and wholesale it necessarily unless it's a slam dunk.
Nice, gotcha. I really appreciate the spouting out of the script pieces. Scripts, knowing what to say, in which situation, it's an endless variation of words that could be delivered by us, the investor, by our organization, meaning yours, mine, any of the listeners' company. And when you get those scripts right, when you get those questions right, when you figure out what to say to the sellers in each specific situation, I mean, for me, I know that's when we really took the limits off of the number of deals that we can do. Do you guys really dig down and dive into the details of scripts, you know, internally, Chris? Is that like a big focus for you?
We do. Good question. So we practice. We also tell the students to not only practice, but in the states where it doesn't require dual party consent, there's a whole bunch of states you can record in without dual party consent. When that is available, we have them tape calls and send them, and we critique them. And that is by far the fastest way to cut down a learning curve, by far, because you get a call, we put the headset on, we critique it, and they go, next call. They're trying the new stuff we just gave them. It's just very fast learning path.
I like it. That's solid. I think you had mentioned before we got on the interview something about $75,000 per deal. Now, Chris, I fix and flip houses. We have something like 85 deals right now in the five markets that I'm in, Atlanta, Miami, Tampa, Chicago, and Philadelphia. Some are being rehabbed. Many are wholesales. $75,000 for one deal, I don't see that. I mean, I've done a handful of deals. We're talking hundreds of deals that I've done, Chris, and I've seen, you know, $75,000 or more on maybe maybe 7 or 8 deals ever. So what is it? You know, you mentioned 75,000. Is that an anomaly? Is that the best deal you've done, or is this something you've seen consistently happen multiple times in your career?
No, that's our actual. I'm going to answer every single piece of that because it's a very important question. That's our actual average to date in 2017. It's actually 78,000 and change. So how do you do that? We create on every single deal 3 paydays, and it solves a lot of your listeners, a lot of the investors' challenges because it solves 3 things: cash now, cash steady, like month to month, and then longer term, kind of that wealth build up, cash out, you know, like a regular conventional sale. So here's how it's done. And by the way, our average is lower than some of our students. So the gentleman that was just here from DC yesterday is one of our top clients, top students. He has his first 6 deals, Dan. Now get this. He's at 650 gross on all 3 paydays. I'm going to explain to you right now. 650 on 6 deals. So he's over 100K. His sales price is higher in that area. Here's how you create the 3 paydays. On any one of those ways I told you we purchase, we're going to sell, I told you, on rent to own. Well, it's going to create, the first payday is going to be when the tenant buyer comes in with a non-refundable down payment. Our actual average right now is somewhere between 22 and 28,000, actual on payday number one. Payday number two is created when you create the spread between either the owner financing payment you're making to the owner or the mortgage payment you're making and the amount you're collecting from the tenant buyer. So there's a monthly spread. Now you get the monthly cash flow. And if you're doing, say, even a dozen deals a year, on average of 300 or 400, you just created 4 or 5 grand a year, a month rather, in income after your first year in business. That's pretty cool for most people. The third payday is the premium in price that you got, obviously, when you sell it. But also on every one of these deals, you have the benefit of principal pay down. With owner financing, 100% principal pay down. On sandwich leases, you have the whatever the underlying mortgage is, whatever the pay down is, $200, $300, $400, $500, up to $1,000. So that third payday ends up being your markup in the price and the principal pay down benefit. So those 3 paydays right now are averaging 78 grand for us.
How many of these deals have you done this year?
I think to date, we just finished 5 months. We're at, I got my board right in front of me, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 to date. And that's because the boys, my son and son-in-law, Nick and Zach, have a goal of 2+ a month. We were at a point where we were taking 5 or 10 a month. Now that we're doing deals all over the country, their goal here in the tri-state is just 2 deals a month, and they're spot on.
Nice. And how many of these have repair or maintenance issues? Here's my problem, Chris. I have, I don't know, 10 or 15 rental units, and I don't really make money at the end of the day because it seems like I'm constantly having to replace refrigerators, the roof's leaking. I mean, these aren't all the nicest properties. I'm going to turn them over because I just bought them recently, but at the end of the year, I don't make anything and I'm having to feed them, so it's a bit of a headache. Do you guys have something to mitigate that, or is there some way around it, or are you guys just set up to deal with those headaches and hassles?
No, we don't deal with it. Specifically, I absolutely will not. We do not rent. And so what's the difference? If you are a buyer of ours, Dan, remember now, when I say tenant buyers rent to own, these are buyers that need time. There's a big difference between a buyer that needs time who has to go through credit enhancement or seasoning as a self-employed individual versus a tenant with a tenant mentality and everything else that goes with it. Secondly, all our agreements with the tenant buyers offload all of the maintenance and repairs and upkeep to the tenant buyer. So they behave, live like, and pay like they own the house. Those repairs are theirs, not ours.
100% of the repairs are passed on to the tenant buyer.
Correct, except for the first 30 days we get from the seller, so we honor it with the buyers. We get a 30-day, call it a little mini warranty between the seller and us, that says anything over $250 because something unbeknownst to us both happened that we didn't expect. Refrigerator blows up, they have to pay it, the seller, so we'll pass it on to our buyer. But after that, the day 31 on, they're on their own.
Cool. So what is the cash out rate? If you do 11 deals this year, I assume 1 to 2 year term, something around that time, maybe it's more or less, maybe you could clarify, but then how many of those would you expect to actually cash out, get the mortgage, keep the house, et cetera, as opposed to just turn it back over to you, which at that point, I assume you're going to just pop it back out again for another tenant buyer. So what's the actual success rate on or closeout rate for these tenant buyers?
Okay, this one's huge too, because all over the internet, this is not, you know, I'm not talking out of school here. you can Google lease purchase, and you can go find mentors, and you can go find people that did it or are doing it still, and you will hear most of them say, well, who cares if the tenant buyer cashed out? You just do it again. There's an issue here internally with the values and mission that I told you about that we don't do that. We make sure the tenant buyers are pre-qualified and have a plan that says they're going to be able to be cashed out by this mortgage-ready date, and that date will fall before our term is up. So the percentage is roughly out of 24 to 40 deals a year, 1 to 3% will have a headache. You know, have 2 to 5 people in a given year that may have a life event, or they get a job transfer, or they file bankruptcy. And these are all things that have happened to us. So in our world, 2 to 5 a year, not too bad, that just can't cash out. And you're right, we'll either turn around and resell it conventionally, or if the term has more time left, because that happened early on, then we just put another tenant buyer in the home. All our terms, to answer that piece of your question, we don't ever do a year. With the sellers, we mostly do 36 and 48 months. On occasion, if it's a great deal and everything lines up and it's a really nice house, then we might do 24 months. But, you know, you alluded to, like, rental property quality. A lot of these homes are great homes. You know, we're doing, in the D.C. area, $700 to $1.9 million homes this method. So these aren't homes that are in rough shape. Very rarely are they in rough shape.
Are the rest of them that don't give you a problem, are they actually cashing out? You guys are going to settlement?
Oh, yeah. Okay. We close homes right now because we've been doing the terms business, you know, laser focus without other techniques since the mid-13. So we're cashing out right now, very steady, anywhere between 1 and 3 a month. And that'll continue for the foreseeable future until we decide to shut it off. If we decide to shut it off right now, in other words, not acquire any property, our funnel would go for another 3 years of cash outs.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Do you guys have, what would be the reason for shutting it off? If the market's declining like it did last time, is that?
No, because we'd buy a boatload of properties then and get longer terms. No, just personal reasons. I said that kind of facetiously. If we said, hey, let's kind of chill out a little bit. I tell you what we will do, and we are doing, and that is we continue to every quarter get pickier and pickier. We don't, quote unquote, need more deals. We need great deals now. We need more owner financing deals. We need, you know, deals that we can eke a little bit more profit out of because we have so much in the pipeline already.
Gotcha. Walk me through one of the deals you did in the last month from the spot where we got them calling back or however it was, they came from an expired listing. So the seller comes to you. I want to know, what's their asking price? Why didn't it sell on, you know, the MLS, the regular channels? What happened with you guys in the negotiation as far as what you agreed to on the purchase price and maybe the agreed to rent amount? Was there a mortgage on that property or not? Maybe walk me through literally every detail on that last deal, Chris.
Okay, I'll tell you what. I've got an owner financing one, which these are my favorite because you get more money out of them and you'll see why. On my desk. So I'll go over this one with you. This might have been, I don't know, 6 or 7 months ago, but it's on my desk. It's simple to explain where I can see it. I'm looking right at the property info sheet. It was a for sale by owner that our VA found. I can see his name at the top of the sheet. His asking price, this gentleman at the time, was $399,000. The comps, you know, if you looked at the basics, I'm talking, you know, without doing a deep dive, his estimate showed around $420,000. We bought the place for, I think it was, we gave him a premium. I'm going to explain why, because most people think this is nuts. But we paid, I think it was $410,000 for the property, a little more than he was asking. Here's why and how. The property was free and clear. His kids were older and gone, and he was divorced. So he was sitting on this big house on 15 acres with a tennis court on a cul-de-sac. So it's a gorgeous property, but he didn't need it anymore. We met. He liked what we're doing. And we negotiated a $1,500 monthly principal payment, zero money down on that 410 with 48 month terms. And we 99.9% of the time will turn around and put a tenant buyer in the home. The market, it happens to be right near a college. I used to do a lot of college properties in the mid 90s. We don't do them now, but it was a no brainer because we got bombarded with students that wanted to lease the home. So with a $1,500 principal payment and then taxes and insurance on top of that, let's say I'm all in for $2,000, we put college students in that for $3,100 a month and have the parents co-signed on the lease. So that's a little bit different exit for us, but the owner financing piece is interesting because do the math, $1,500 times 48 months. I don't know exactly off the top of my head what that comes to. I don't have my worksheet in front of me, but it's a lot of money off of that principal. So, you know, I'll pay off somewhere down in the low threes, and that'll be a no-brainer cash out. Even if the market dove a little bit, we're more than fine. That's why I love the owner financing deals.
That's pretty cool. Did you participate yourself in the communication with that seller? Were you, like, involved on that conversation,
Chris? I actually did this one. My son-in-law, Zach, does 99.999% of our stuff. Now he's kind of replaced me in our buying, but I actually spoke with this gentleman.
Cool. Let's talk about that conversation. I mean, he wants this amount, $1,500 to me, Chris. I'm just like anyone listening is probably like, what? Why didn't he just rent the property himself for $3,100, right?
A ton of people won't do it because they don't want to mess with it. They want closure. This will magnify this point a lot. We recently bought another one, owner financing. We did have to put some money down, breaking the rules, but we just got it from another deal. It was 10 grand, but the property was $965,000. $1 million oceanfront home. So they say, so you'd say again, well, why did she do it? It's a single woman. Why did she do it? Well, it's usually not price, Dan, as you probably know. It's the whole circumstance. She had a sick mom. She did not want to deal with it. Now, here's another punchline you'll love. She was a realtor. So you'd think, well, what the heck? Why didn't she just rent it? Why would she do owner? She didn't want the mental and the emotional connection. So it's always, if the investors are listening, I don't care if you're wholesaling, you're doing rehabs, it doesn't matter. Don't get caught up on price. Get caught up on why they're selling. That's where the key is. That's where you can figure out how to structure a deal.
Yeah, that's really a great point. I'd love to highlight for everybody listening. You know, people are always looking for the jewels of wisdom on my show, and you just dropped the huge one right there, Chris. Why are they selling the property? I used to joke around when I first started, you know, doing business with other people who are helping me out, running leads together, partners, et cetera. I'd say, I don't even want to know the address of the property. I don't care what the asking price is. I don't want the beds and baths. I don't want to look at photos. I want no information. But first thing, the most important thing I want to know from your conversation with them, tell me why they're selling the property. And when you get down to, you know, those reasons that match the right reasons for us to do a deal, you know, you got something on the hook. At that point, once I've heard the right answer to the reasoning for sale, Chris, all right, let's talk about the condition. Let's talk about the numbers. Let's talk about the neighborhood, the beds, baths, et cetera, et cetera. But first things first, why are you selling that property?
Absolutely. Spot on.
All right, cool. So tenant buyer sources, Chris, what are your best sources of tenants? Maybe you could talk about a situation of one or two of those people who've come along and plunked down $20,000 to $30,000 to participate in one of these homes, and kind of maybe their reason for doing that.
Yeah, great. So sources is hard to say because most of the portals we post to, you know, it probably hits 21, 15, whatever websites, be it RentLinks or Zillow or Craigslist, you know, hits all of those besides our own website. Now, when we first started, I remember having a buyer's list of 25 people. We have several thousand, I think it's over 3,000 now on our list. So they'll get hit first, and then we'll hit the normal postings. My son Nick runs that. He's our buyer specialist. Now, as far as why would a buyer do this? Well, let's look at the two main reasons. One is I'm self-employed. I'm a plumber. Let's just pick that. I go into the bank because prior to 08, I used to walk in a bank and get a stated income loan. I did them. You probably did them. And now I'm not going to say anymore you can't, because they're offering the product again now, but it's very expensive. You're going to pay 7 or 8%. So, okay, so that takes most people away from a stated income loan. So they walk in the bank, they got 50 grand, they're ready to buy a house. The bank says, no, we don't do that anymore. Or you haven't bought since 08, we just don't do those. So now they got to season themselves, seasoning just time. They need time to report their income for 2 years with the IRS so that then a mortgage broker can get them or a bank can get them financed. So where do they go in the meantime? They got a great down payment. They actually have good credit. They just need time. Rentone is perfect. And frankly, they're a great buyer for us because, like, the credit's not an issue. More so, I wish it was more of them, but more so you get the people that got dinged on their credit. It was a divorce. It was a death. It was a life event like I had in 08 or you had, and that happens. It's not the anomaly. It's 80% of the market in most markets. So these people need a game plan. We get them pre-qualified. We do that with a credit repair, credit enhancement company. And then sometimes if the terms tight, we even have them talk to a mortgage broker at the same time. So now we have a mortgage plan that they sign off on and they agree to. So there's a default at the end, or they get amnesia and they forget that we helped them at the beginning, and now they want to, you know, point blame if they have a life event. That doesn't happen because everyone agrees to a game plan that this will be cashed out on or before such and such date. And those are the two main categories we deal with. I'm sure there are other nuances and exceptions, but those are the two main ones. And it, I'll tell you, like the last week, my son and son-in-law had a buyer's meeting here. We called a buyer's meeting, and the wife was on FaceTime. She could make it, and the husband was here, and he got choked up. I mean, people get emotional because a lot of these people think, I'm done. My credit got trashed. I give up. I'm done. We had one woman, I'll give you one more example. This is interesting because three things happened here. She called me on a home, a $500,000 home, had a salon that cash flowed quite nicely because they have to provide all this to get pre-qualified. But she had a process of in vitro being done, and it cost her $90,000+, and she had to file bankruptcy. So she had great cash flow. She had great family. Everything was in order, but her credit was trashed. Now, fast forward. This was several years ago. About 6 months ago, she closed on that home. She also, at the same time, had a condo in Boston that she needed to sell, and she did it with us on a lease purchase. And those attorneys that I put in that home have now cashed her out. And third, she became a student, and she's out doing these deals. That's a pretty cool story.
Yeah, that is a cool one. Do you guys pop these on the MLS? Is there a rent-to-own and for-sale listing on every one of these while you're looking for your tenant buyer, or do you just avoid the whole realtor market altogether?
No, super good question. So if it's one that's not selling for whatever reason, too high in price, weird area, functionality, anything, we might try a list only. We don't do it often, but we do it. We had recently a gentleman who was by far one of our better payers, great guy, didn't hear from much at all. That's the ideal relationship because everybody's doing what they're supposed to do. He hit the skids with a partner. I don't know what happened, but he filed bankruptcy and had to leave the home. We put that on the market, list only, and sold it through a co-broker realtor. So on occasion, we'll do that. I was a broker for 18 years. I respect them. It's just that we don't need them most of the time. And I know you have listeners or probably have listeners that are realtors. I'll say this to them. If you will just commit a little bit to learning how to do deals on terms, there's 100% chance that 100% of your appointments you go on, you can take when you learn how to buy them if you can't list and sell them. So now you just have more in your bag of tricks to talk with a seller about instead of walking away from a over-leveraged house or walking away if they say, man, I owe about what it's worth. I can't afford the fee. I guess I'll stay. There's all these deals you could take as an investor that you can't list and sell as a realtor, and man, what another profit center you could have.
I know. It really does sound great in theory is what I'm saying, right? It's my kickback. The issue is this that I'm having a little trouble with, Chris. Let's say we go on the appointment from the real estate agent's perspective. We go on the appointment. The guy wants $399,000. The comps are $390,000, and you can still put something together. How are we managing to pack an average still profit of $70,000? I mean, even $40,000, $50,000 seems unrealistic unless the market continues to move upward. Can you walk me through, you know, how much of a discount or how far detached from the reality of the comps can I be on one of these, you know, potential listing appointments? Or even if I was just going as a potential deal maker like yourself, you know, how much negative equity is too much? You know, what would some of those numbers, some of those limits be, and how would we still make money, if at all?
Yep, fantastic. So what I'll do is I'll walk you through that very deal that you just said, $399 and $390, by asking you a few questions, and we'll do the deal together, and we'll do the three paydays together. So too much, $9,000 wouldn't be too much. Too much might be, in most markets, anything more than 10%. I'm just using it as a rough idea. So if you told me $450 and $380, yeah, that's, unless you gave me 10 years lease purchase, I can't really make that up. Which, by the way, I've done several at 9 years for that reason. So let's work on this one deal. $399 and $390 is not a big deal. On a person carrying a mortgage at $390, let me ask you so you can plug in the numbers by just answering. What do you think on a $390 mortgage the principal pay down might be?
I mean, depending on the number of years that they've had that, I would guess they would be in there for probably 5 to 7 years. I don't know, maybe in how long? 4 years, you said? How much would it pay down?
No, just 1 month. What do you think that, like you said, might not be that high because it might be a new loan. What do you think one mortgage payment is going to be professional?
Probably $300 to $400 if I had to guess.
I would agree. So let's go with $300. So times 12. So each year, let's say we're going to have $3,600 in principal pay down, right?
Yep.
Okay. If I mark that house up only to, let's go very conservative to $429. Now, you're going to see the comp may or may not be an issue. Let's play it out. So we got $30,000 on the markup, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. With your typical tenant buyer, we're going to be somewhere between 5 and 7%, but just because you and I are doing this verbally, let's use only 5%. So on a 429 house, a 5% deposit is going to be 21 grand-ish. Let's say they're going to put down $21,000, the tenant buyer. Now you got payday one is $21,000. You got payday two. I don't know the mortgage payment. Let's say this person's mortgage payment was $2,000. And we're going to go out to market at only 23. You can usually eke out 300 to 1,000. I'm going conservative on every one of these numbers. So we got a $300 monthly spread on for payday two. So we pick up $3,600 a year there. And then we picked up, if you remember, $3,600 on the principal pay down per year. So the answer to these over-leveraged homes, even though this one's not too over-leveraged, is time. You can't do, I wouldn't do, a 24-month lease. I'd want a 48 or a 60. So if you got a 60-month lease, start to do the math. 5 years times the $3,600 in principal pay down. 5 years times the $3,600 a year in monthly spread. And then your markup of $30,000, which of which you got 21 up front, there's still at least 50 or 60 grand in this house, if not 70, 80.
Gotcha. So they will get credit for their down payment on the markup, correct?
All the tenant buyers get 100% credit on their deposit against my new sales price. Yes. And so some might say, well, you just marked it up even higher. Don't they know that? Yeah. But you just told them they can lock that price in for 4 years, hypothetically, or three, whatever you give them, five. So you say, look at Mr. and Mrs. Tenant Buyer, you can go rent now and save while the market sails right past you and you're on a treadmill. Or just as if you were a buyer, even though you can't get a loan, we're going to lock your price in today at 429. They feel like a homeowner. They feel like they're getting equity. They feel, you know, there's a sense of pride around that.
Is there an issue if the market doesn't continue to move in the correct direction? Let's say that this same one, you know, comes back, they want to exercise the option and, you know, place appraises at $390,000 when they go to do the refinance. How would you handle that situation?
Okay, so it can happen, and some of the appraisals, even in a good market right now, that happens. We either reappraise it and hope for the best, or in most cases, time-wise, you just renegotiate. Now, to give you the legal answer, all of our contracts have nothing to do with appraisal. So the appraisal basically, the tenant buyer's contract basically says, look, Dan, your price is $429. At the end, if there's a difference in appraisal, you're going to come up with a difference in cash or you're going to walk away from your deal. None of them are contingent like the conventional deals on appraisal.
Gotcha. Is that an issue or a scenario where you'd consider refunding partially their down payment? Have you ever had to do something of that nature, or has it been enough to renegotiate or have people walked away in that scenario if it didn't appraise?
Haven't had a walk away, knock on wood. No, haven't. But keep in mind, since the end of 12, beginning of 13, in defense of your question, there hasn't been a slump major in any one of those. So with the principal pay down you have on all these deals with the right term, then you have the wiggle room to negotiate. We had one that come back. Let me give you an example. I had a 5-year lease purchase with a gentleman. I think it started back in like 13. So in theory, that would just be cashing out. 11 months into it, the buyer's called and said, hey, good news. I got financing. I'm thinking to myself, good news. I don't know if this thing's going to work. So long story short, the appraisal came in not bad. It came in around 11,000 too low. I knew and the seller knew, and he had inherited the home, but he knew also that the appraiser probably shortchanged us and we probably should order a new one and pay for it. Instead, he said, look, Chris, do you mind taking a hit, $5,000? I'll take a hit, $5,000. We both did that and let the buyer just close. So it was a no big
nice
deal for either one of us. You know, so we helped them instead of putting them through pain of trying to drag the thing out. And now, funny story there, that buyer has since cashed that house out, obviously at that 11th month point, but also gave me one of their homes that was upside down, just like your last question, that I still have because I did a seven-year term on that one because it was upside down. We still have it.
Do you see a price point where it's too low? It sounds like the 300, 400, or even the higher dollar amount price points seem to be where you gravitate. Is that intentionally? Are they just the examples you shared? Or is there a price point that might be too low that the market movement might not make this a sustainable and good deal for us as an investor?
I like the lower end too. We have plenty of owner financing deals. We did one at one, I think it was like 110 owed. Took it subject to, sold for like 140. That's about to cash out this year. This probably within a month. Did another one. It was 177. Now we won't have time to do this, but let me give you the numbers. This will blow your mind. We did a deal for 177, and that was about 2.5 years ago. I'm converting that right now to owner financing in my IRA, and I'm recalibrating the term for 60 months from now. We're closing this July 30. And there's $177,000 profit on an original price of 177 because I picked up a lot next door and because it's principal pay down. That would get people thinking.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Man, I could probably go on for another hour or so, but I'm going to be respectful of your time. I got one more question before we switch gears here to our wrap up. And that is, Chris, can you tell the audience, why is it that you do the coaching? What's your motivation for teaching other people how to get started?
Yep, everyone asks that, especially at events. So here's the deal. The buying and selling piece of this will probably also surprise people. You can click around two deals a month, no problem, in 2.5-3 days a week, tops. You don't need more time than that. So I told you that my son and son-in-law took over the buying and selling with the team, some great support people. So that I'm not needed there. And so you won't notice till you do it, anyone listening, but the pleasure and the satisfaction of taking a student. Now we rev share, so there's obviously a win-win. We're doing deals all over the country, but the challenge and the gratification of taking someone in many cases with zero experience or in a lot of cases with less than positive experience from other people out there in the trenches, like you said, or not in the trenches, mentoring or trying to coach, is just phenomenal. And so we're taking people with zero experience and then watch them do six deals at 650 grand and things of that nature. It's just phenomenal. And again, we're rev sharing, just in full disclosure. So it's a fun process to teach and it's a fun process to profit around the country.
I like it. You know, I tried along the way, held a couple seminars, never really got into the coaching angle, but I find that, you know, I'm blessed to have a great team. And for me, it was a similar thing where I would coach these, usually it's newer people who become partners of mine, who weren't really in the business or maybe trying the business with not much sustainable success. And we've come together, my partners and I, and I kind of function in a lot of cases like the coach and the mentor for those guys and gals around the country. And it is a bit of a revenue share, but we're all, you know, tightly organized with partnerships, et cetera. So for me, I love watching people succeed. I don't have a way, unfortunately, to do it for a massive number of people just for the fact that my time is really limited. But it's good to hear, you know, a similar motivation there. So, Chris, I have a question here that I want you to answer two ways. First would be, what would be one or two book recommendations you would make to somebody who is just getting started in the business? And then second, what are one or two book recommendations you would make to somebody who's already successful in real estate?
Well, you know, it might surprise you, but I don't know as though I'd have someone read a real estate book per se and think that that was the next best step. But because I think they're always for support. I think more so people need in any business, but certainly the case with all our clients, they need more of the mental game to succeed in real estate, if that makes sense to you. Because all the mentors can teach you, and you, me, anyone can teach you the basic, the logistics. It's the mental game that's going to get in the way, unbeknownst to a lot of people. So, I mean, we have a best-selling book. It's called Real Estate on Your Terms. I don't know if you knew that. So people, if they want a book, grab the book. It's on Amazon. But if you want a kind of a life book to get in the game of real estate and sustain yourself, I love Life in Air. And I love busting the cash flow something or that. I'm sorry, I don't know the tail end of it, but just go on Amazon and type in busting the cash flow and then type in Life in Air. Those are great books, just kind of life/mind books and money books that'll get you in the right place to then go crank it up in real estate, if that makes sense.
It does. And you kind of bring up a good point, too. We ask for book recommendations on almost every episode. I typically order them from Amazon as you're speaking. But it's important for people listening to figure out if these book recommendations that certain people are giving you are just the most recent book recommendation or if they have been suggested by somebody who maybe knows your intimate situation, knows how far along you are in the process to make a stellar book recommendation. And I know that for my team that I mentioned earlier, There's certain books that make sense right at the beginning, depending on where they're at. Certain books, once they've dealt with situations like looking at too much money in the bank, is a problem for a lot of people. When they start making good money, there's a host of challenges that come up around that. And there's certain books that would be recommended at that point in time, and then so on and so on, depending on where at in their business building they are. So it's really a good thing to pay attention to if it's the right time and the right book.
You bring up a huge point, Dan, because someone will say, what's your favorite book? Well, this month it's this because I'm in this stage of my business, but last year it was entirely different. This year I'm on a mission to create culture and scalability and have a cool team. Well, that wasn't the case 3 years ago. So I'll give you a cool book for everyone. The Hard Things About the Hard Things. It came up on my podcast. Someone gave it to me. The Hard Things About the Hard Things. Really cool book.
Yeah, absolutely. I got that one on my shelf. I remember reading it too.
Nice.
So, Chris, if you could go back, 25 years ago and share the crown jewel of wisdom with yourself as you were maybe just getting started in real estate, what would that be?
You know, almost any year you plugged in there, because I think it's a cool question you ask, I would kind of go this route. Find some of the things you and I just alluded to. Find a mentor or teacher, someone you can trust, and make sure that a couple things are in place. One, you can mesh with them. You don't have to love them, because there's an amount of respect. I coach very bluntly with people, but as long as you respect what we're doing. Two, they're in your niche. And three, they're doing still today what you want to get accomplished. Not they did it 10 years ago, and quite frankly, in real estate, if they did it even 6 months ago and stopped, things have changed too much. You're going to get burnt. So they got to be in the trenches, kind of like we are with that with the family. And that's going to make it work. Now, when I say mentors, I don't just mean, remember, we just talked mental game, you and I both. So I don't just mean real estate mentors. I mean, look at your life. Do you need a nutrition coach, a workout coach? Do you also need a real estate coach? Look at all areas and try to, in the next X amount of years, do that. That's what I would have told myself way back then. And I didn't start that long ago. Second thing is commit to 12 to 36 months. I think this is a huge challenge in real estate. People get caught up in the shiny object, or too many expectations are set, or frankly, too many promised by mentors that says, it's a get rich overnight, or this is easy. No, you're going to work your butt off, but the return is phenomenal. And in time, you'll learn how to get a great lifestyle out of that. But it's not going to be tomorrow, and it's not going to be in 30 days. And so just set the expectations proper. That was something I wish certainly someone told me day one. And then last one, nothing to do with real estate. Set it up so you're going to live on 50% of what you're bringing in, and you'll create a phenomenal lifestyle.
Nice. Well said. The piece about picking the right mentor, I know for me it's always worked well, and I could trust the advice of my business partners who are, in a sense, my mentors. So where there's a revenue share in the mentor's relationship, you can be sure that that mentor who's working on that deal with you we'll pay more attention than if it were a pay by the hour or pay once, done kind of hit 10 grand down. Here's your mentor. And then you're off to the races. There's going to be a different level of attention paid to your success if you both have a common goal. I know that necessarily won't work with the nutrition coach or with my personal trainer that I see 3 days a week, but, cool. Chris, if anyone wants to get some more information about you, do you have a link, URL, or contact information you'd like to share with the audience?
Yes, simple. I'll give you a couple. You can go to smartrealestatecoach.com, smartrealestatecoach.com. There's a free webinar there. If you don't mind listening to me for another hour, you can go on there. It's content rich and enjoy it. And the niche you want to delve into, just hit the contact button on there somewhere. And we have a show as well. I'd actually love to have you on the show, Dan, because you're in a different niche than us, and so we should hook up on that. But our show is smartrealestatecoachpodcast.com.
All right. I will make sure that I put both of those URLs in the show notes there for the listeners who want to check it out. Hey, Chris, I know you're busy doing a lot of different things, so am I. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to come on and share this time with the REI Diamond Show listeners.
Oh, it's a pleasure, and I hope to have you on ours as well, and hopefully we can keep in communication.
And thank you, my loyal listener, for checking out this episode of the REI Diamond Show. If you are interested in checking out the next episode pre-released a day or two before the email goes out, please subscribe on YouTube or one of the podcasting apps, including iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher. If you have investment capital on the sidelines, not already earning above average returns, you should check out SuperchargedReturns.com. When you enter your email address there, I'll send you an email when the next upcoming private mortgage investment opportunity becomes available in either Chicago, Atlanta, Florida, or Philadelphia. Those private mortgages are then used to fund my fix and flip projects, as well as some short-term, 90 days or less, wholesale deals. Again, that site is superchargedreturns.com. Finally, if you have certain questions or topics you'd like discussed on a future episode, or if you have a guest suggestion, somebody that you'd like me to invite on the show, contact me by clicking on the Contact Dan link at reidiamonds.com. You can also download a copy of my book on wholesaling, Become a Wholesale Real Estate Master, pretty much my business plan for wholesaling deals, at that site, reidiamonds.com. Thank you once again for being a loyal listener of the REI Diamond Show. Dan Breslin here. I'll catch you next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.